Hello, and welcome to episode 121 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Stuart Schwartz, founder and executive director of the Coalition for Smarter Growth, a retired Navy captain and a graduate of Virginia Sorensen Institute. We're also joined by Amy Custis, the deputy director at Coalition for Smarter Growth and editor at the urbanist blog Greater Greater Washington. Stuart, Amy, great to have you. How are you doing today?
Great.
Thanks for having us.
Excellent. The first question I'd like to pose to you, we'll start with Stuart, is what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Sought to advance the public interest in everything I've done in my career. Entering the U.S. military, the U.S. Navy to serve during the Cold War was very meaningful to me. Service to my country, but I think what caused me to leave the Navy was a desire to make our own communities better. Mm-hmm. I went on to law school thinking about working in environmental law, but it came down to communities themselves, placemaking, transportation and land use, and that's what I've done for the last 21 years. 20 years of it at the Coalition for Smarter Growth.
You're very engaged in communities and placemaking in Virginia in particular, and you've been engaged in local Virginia politics. Are you actually local to this area? Is this where you're originally from?
So, no, I'm from New York and Connecticut.
Okay.
This is an example of a great university system. The University of Virginia attracted me here.
You're a double who.
And I'm a double who. I did law school afterward. That's right. And I think what's important to talk about with Virginia is what I saw was the scenic beauty, uh-huh, and the character and the history of the Commonwealth,
yeah,
not to mention a great university system. And I think that attracts the best and brightest. We've also, though, seen a lot of that landscape transformed over the last 30, 40 years, and not all of it for the better. We've lost a lot of our history. We've lost a lot of that scenic beauty. And we sit in traffic all the time. So there's a desire to keep Virginia and the greater Washington, D.C. region as a better place.
Now, I saw that you founded the Coalition for Smarter Growth in the 90s, which is about the same time that Governor Paris Glendening of the state of Maryland really got smart growth on a national map. Is there any correlation there?
Absolutely. I mean, some of the founders of our organization were groups in Maryland that had been working with Governor Glendening on smart growth in Maryland. My predecessors, the people who passed it on to me, were leaders of some of the regional conservation groups, the major regional conservation groups in the Washington, D.C. region. They were great mentors.
Mm-hmm.
They cared about the environment and recognized that where and how we grow makes a real difference. What I'm excited about is there were very few of us back then, but there are many of us now in Amy's generation and the next generation who are really picking up the flag and carrying on this cause of smart growth.
So segueing on to the newer generation, Amy, you're here with the Coalition for Smarter Growth as the deputy director. Tell us a little bit about what's motivating you every day. How is it that you conceptualize your work here and also your work on a Greater Greater Washington blog as a means of advancing the public interest?
Sure. So I actually studied architecture and political science in college, and I was one of those do-gooders growing up that I always really wanted to make a difference in my community and serve the public interest, but I didn't really know in focus how I wanted to do that. And then my junior year of undergraduate, I went to school at Tulane in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
That was 2005. We were hit by Hurricane Katrina.
Hmm.
And Katrina really, as anyone knows, devastated the city and was a very formative moment,
mm-hmm,
for everyone in my community at that time. And becoming someone who had to leave what was my home and experiencing that and then coming back a few months later to a city that was trying to rebuild itself but mired in a lot of geopolitical, sociopolitical, environmental messes that,
mm-hmm,
were all tangled up with one another, it really became to me a call that what I wanted to do was help people and help environmental issues. And that's how I ended up working in smart growth.
So it seems as though there's a common theme of the intersection between home, community, place, and environmental awareness and sustainability. How does that play out in the actual office here in the work that you do? How do you guys work with each other to make sure that communities are sustainable and also environmentally friendly?
Well, we work across the whole Washington, D.C. region, Montgomery and Prince George's in Maryland, D.C. and Northern Virginia. Mm-hmm. We even do some state policy. We talk regionally and act locally is what we say, where we certainly have to work together as a region. We have to have an interconnected region with Metro at the core of it.
Yeah.
And our vision, as you know, we built from the bottom up in our work, is that a network of transit-oriented centers and communities is the best way for our region to grow sustainably. What it means is that more people will be living in these walkable, bikeable places. There will be a range of housing affordability in each of these centers, and transit will be a viable option for many of your daily needs.
So is a lot of what the Coalition for Smarter Growth is about, is it often centered? It seems very urban-centric, because transit-oriented development is kind of, you need a minimum threshold of density in order to warrant investment in mass transit. This isn't for rural America, is it?
Yes and no. Transit-oriented development tends to, as you said, work best in places that has the density to support it. Mm-hmm. But I think it would be a missed opportunity not to point out the fact that by building here, not there, mm-hmm. in a way that we often describe it, that helps everyone. There is real value to low density, beautiful places here in the DC region, just outside of the immediate metro area. We have the Virginia Piedmont with beautiful farms and forests and all of those places. And if we don't concentrate ourselves in certain areas, it makes it really hard to keep those other areas beautiful. So now, it's about both.
You mentioned the Piedmont region in Virginia. Now, the Piedmont Environmental Council was one of several of the organizations in the original coalition, along with the Audubon Society, Sierra Club, Chesapeake Bay Foundation. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to build this coalition and how you're able to be effective, especially since they're all on kind of one side of the political spectrum? Now, in Maryland, you have more of a left-leaning legislature and frequently a Democratic governor, although we've had now two Republican governors. In Virginia, it's more of a mixed bag with a Republican-controlled legislature. How are you able to advance these policies, and how receptive are they along different ends of the political spectrum?
Well, I would say that smart growth cuts across political boundaries, and in the sense that not only is it good for the environment, but it's good for the pocketbook and for the taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
The amount that the American landscape, the American development has spread outward is costing us all.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to have a phrase, sprawl costs us all. But because the transportation, water and sewer, police and fire, all that infrastructure is much more expensive per capita as you spread farther out. It's just harder to serve everybody being very spread out. Even the utility companies have to pay more to string wire to fewer homes spread over more acres. And that means we all end up subsidizing the more spread out development. And what many jurisdictions are finding is that through walkable communities, more compact communities, they can save on infrastructure costs and we can reduce other problems like traffic congestion.
A lot of times in the public policy world, a good analogy to describe the topic of the day is a pendulum. And as you might imagine, a grandfather clock, a pendulum will go to one side and then the other. So at one point in the early 20th century, a lot of the desire was for individuals who are trapped in the city to get out of the city into the suburbs. So you have the trolley lines and people are going out and you have the hub and spoke model of mass transit. But then later in the 20th century, especially now, you have the millennial generation that finds that downtown and urban areas are actually where it's most desirable, and transit-oriented development, where there is more density and more walkable amenities, is more desirable. Can you talk a little bit about, I guess, how the American dream fits in, what the real root causes of suburban sprawl are? If this is something that, is it just going to eventually reverse and go back to suburban sprawl in another generation when, again, the cities are too crowded and the pendulum swings back?
And you really mean to make this a short podcast?
Yeah.
Well, certainly I think the automobile had a primary factor, especially after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Before World War II, yes, the industrial cities and the pollution certainly contributed to pushing people outward. Mm-hmm. That's not the way industry is anywhere pretty much anymore. And the automobile, though, and the desire for sort of space and the sense that, oh, I would have less traffic if I moved farther out, were all factors. But quickly, you know, we realized that wasn't always the case, that the traffic returned, the problems of poor planning return. And we've all been able to show the benefits of a great walkable urban environment. I want to give some credit, though, to the Congress for the New Urbanism, which was founded in Alexandria around 1991, mm-hmm. around the same time as the Smart Growth Movement. This was based out of the architecture community, and it looked back to how our historic towns and cities once worked.
Mm-hmm.
They had a network of streets. They had a mix of different types of uses. They had all the aspects of a community in a walkable environment. You know, many of these communities were first built, of course, well before the automobile.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been very effective in working across the country, including in rural America, and showing the benefits of town building like we once did.
So, Amy, to bring it back to you, obviously we're both, for our listeners who can't see, we're both of a millennial generation. Do you have any statistics or data about what the role is of our generation in driving this smart growth agenda forward?
I think it's less about hard numbers, though I could have certainly brought in some of those. I don't have them at my fingertips right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when I get out and I talk to people, and more for millennials, but I feel like millennial is also just kind of this empty word at this point, like globalization or one of those other words. And a lot of people mean a lot of different things by millennials. So
mm-hmm.
let's stop and maybe talk about what we mean about millennials. When I'm using that word here, I mean people who were born at or after 1982, no matter where they live or what their economic background looks like.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times we'll hear a sort of elite press talking about millennials as the Brooklyn hipsters as opposed to a much broader audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for millennials in the broader sense, for all of us, that it really is about a couple of things. One, it is about the economics.
Mm-hmm.
When I moved to DC, I moved here in 2008 because it was one of the few places that I didn't have a lot of money and I thought that I could live comfortably without a personal automobile.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple of choices, and as it turned out, I thought DC was the best of them, and here I am. And so that's a real economic driver.
So you really wanted to avoid having the costs associated with automobile ownership, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is quite almost 180 degrees away from the perspective of people in their 20s and 30s in the 1950s and 60s. Is that correct?
Well, even me, growing up in the 70s. I mean, you wanted a car. You had to have a car to move around in the suburbs. But I think what people have realized is that you can be very entrapped by the cost of owning a car. I mean, when AAA, the car guys
mm-hmm.
actually talk about the cost of owning a four-door sedan over its lifetime can be something like $9,600 a year.
Mm-hmm.
That really adds up.
Mm-hmm.
That's money that you could be saving and spending towards college, saving for a down payment on a home. And it's a depreciating asset, unlike a home or an education. So there's been an eye-opening about the cost of car ownership, and I think that's why you're going to see the next generation, not just what we've started with the millennials, but for everyone, will be these shared ownership models, these shared use models that we're seeing with cars today.
So would it be correct to characterize the relationship between smart growth and the automobile as a somewhat antagonistic at loggerheads relationship?
No. The way we usually phrase it is that in the period after World War II, we only built one type of community. You know, we abandoned our cities and most of our towns,
mm-hmm.
and we built one type of suburban model that was completely dependent on the automobile and offered no choice.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you were a young pre-driving teenager,
mm-hmm.
you had no choices. You had no options for getting around. I mean, you could try your bike on something, but the roads are pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do is bring choice back into the human community. Different modes of transportation that give you options and freedom that don't require the cost of owning a car, and more choices about types of housing. There's not just single-family homes, but you have many other choices of housing as well.
And I think that that's really something that we're seeing in American society more broadly right now, is in the past decade or so moving back against a monoculture movement. You can think about industrial farming where, you know, we're farming hundreds of acres of a particular crop, but in the slow food movement and in the local food movement, we're seeing, you know, farming a lot of more local crops in smaller quantities together in the same fields and farms, and so it's not something that's just happening in land use and planning. It's something that's happening in American society more widely.
So speaking about the sociological changes that are occurring perhaps in relation and concurrently with smart growth, would you say that by creating these denser communities and having people in greater proximity to one another, as opposed to being in a suburban community where you commute from work to home, park in your own garage, and don't speak to anybody, would you say that there's some kind of a positive effect on community building and creation of a sense of place?
Oh my goodness, yes. So I said before there were a couple of things about millennials, and the first one was the economy. The second one is what I affectionately refer to in the office as living the dream. I live in DuPont Circle here in DC. I'm very fortunate to have an apartment there. And one of the things that I love is, unlike my friends who have bought homes to drive till they qualify to Centerville every day but still work downtown, is I have 25 minutes of commute on the metro. I regularly run into people I know on that commute on a day-to-day basis. I have a friend who lives across the neighborhood, and I see her walking her children to daycare twice a week on my way into the office in the morning. And that's just not ever something that, if she lived in Centerville and she was driving till she qualified, she would put the kids in the minivan. And it's a much lonelier lifestyle.
So a tagline of Public Interest Podcast is revealing our humanity. Would it be fair to say that transit-oriented development and the goal of Coalition for Smarter Growth is a very humanizing goal, where we're really trying to attempt to engage each other in our own communities a bit more?
Absolutely. And we owe, again, a lot to the new urbanists for this, as they looked at our historic towns and how they functioned. I mean, they've even looked at things like the importance of front porches and how close the front porch is located to the sidewalk. Not too close, not too far, mm-hmm. so that you can have a conversation over the rail of the front porch with neighbors going by. And I live in a row house neighborhood where it can take 40 minutes to go three blocks to the post office, walkable from my house, because you're bumping into so many people that you're talking to.
Interesting. So the commute is actually, in terms of time, could be similar as with a car, but it's because there's a rich, vibrant experience of engaging with their community. In fact, the commute is almost a social experience, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And it's these fortuitous interactions you have with people, whether it's on the metro or on the bus or on the sidewalk, that can make a difference. And there's a reason why Richard Florida and others talk about the strength of the creative economy in mm-hmm. cities and metropolitan areas. Mm-hmm. And you know, they use a very technical term, a heavy term called agglomeration economy, but it is basically the gathering together, the coming together and interaction of people that creates great ideas. And yes, we have an internet, but, you know, you can't trust everything you read on the internet, right? But what you can trust is face-to-face interactions, brainstorming at the coffee shop, those sorts of things. And that is where in fact, they even show that the numbers of patents that come out of urban places is so much higher because of this interaction.
Sounds like a macro implementation of Steve Jobs' water cooler effect at Apple, where he tried to maximize, as I understand it, interactions among different employees, because when you have someone from tech department interacting with someone from engineering department and someone from marketing department, you end up getting crazy new ideas, and that's what really innovation is all about. So does smarter growth and all of this increased exposure to each other, it sounds like it really does have many positive externalities that both help the economy and help the vibrancy of a community.
Absolutely. Richard Florida has done a lot of writing about what he terms the creative class. My favorite example on this is the WeWork phenomenon that seems to be taking over in the District of Columbia right now. Everybody in the millennial generation wants to go work at WeWork because not only do you get free coffee and a cool space, but because the people who you are surrounding yourself with aren't just your coworkers in your own organization, but the guys down the hallway are, you know, coming up with the newest artisanal toothbrush manufacturing, and the people at the other end of the hall are small-time investment bankers, and you have the lawyer down the hall as well, And there are all of these communal spaces that you find yourself mixing in. It's a very sort of microcosmic version of what we're doing at a regional scale.
So, Amy, to segue off that topic that you just raised about the communal workspace, you are an editor at the Greater Washington. So perhaps you might be able to speak about what would constitute a Greater Washington.
One of my favorite questions. There are a lot of things about the DC region that are already great, but there are a lot of things that we could do to make it even better. One of the really great things we've been talking about our cities is the vibrancy that diversity brings. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges that we're having in diverse places, mm-hmm. in diverse urban places, is pricing people out, to use the G word, mm-hmm. gentrification. Mm-hmm. And one of the things the Coalition for Smarter Growth actually works on is making sure that our region is a place that everyone can afford to live, work, and play in. And so one of the biggest things is affordable housing, and making sure that affordable housing isn't shunted off to some undesirable corner of the region, but mixing it in among the most vibrant places in our region, because it's really that diversity that makes the mix work.
Can you speak, Stuart, a little bit more about how affordable housing got included into your mission?
Well, it's always been a part of the mission, along with environment. As Amy said, the healthiest communities are those that have a mix of incomes, a great diversity, and are not, you know, what we used to build, monocultures. You know, mm-hmm. you would have the first ring suburb. Then the families would get older, the kids would go off to college, they would stay there, mm-hmm. the next suburb would become the family suburb, and then the next one would, and then you would just leave a certain age group in each suburb. But mm-hmm. now we think we should mix it up by income and age and so forth. I think the challenge we've seen is that the demand to live in walkable urban places is such that the prices have gone beyond the reach of many people. Mm-hmm. To us, that's a supply problem. We're not providing enough housing close to jobs, close to transit in these places. So let's talk in particular about the suburbs. The city's doing great now.
It's almost a problem that you'd love to have. If you have to have, exactly.
Well, you know, there's the Yogi Berra term that nobody goes there anymore, it's too crowded.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the cities are popular. Walkable urban places in this region are very popular. We have the most in the country, apparently, mm-hmm. according to Chris Leinberger. But it's the how the suburbs are going to evolve. You know, they're choking on their traffic. You've built out your single-family home neighborhoods, and of course they're pretty and they have trees and all that. Mm-hmm. But what about, where are we going to grow? Where can the seniors or older households downsize to and mm-hmm. still stay in the community? Where can young people, when they come back from college, live in the community? And we are focused there on these commercial corridors, not just the metro stations, but, say, the Route 1 corridor or Rockville Pike 355 or mm-hmm. Pennsylvania Avenue and East Capitol. Can we create these walkable urban places within those corridors with new transit, a network of streets, walkability, and a range of housing? And that's our future. It'll give people the same, you know, great options that you might have in a city or a town today.
So it sounds like the Coalition for Smarter Growth is obviously trying to create more livable, walkable, bikeable communities. But of course, there's a history of not creating those, which is what we've termed in this conversation suburban sprawl. Has there been any effort or any policy-making initiative to try to retroactively address those things by leveling those communities and bringing them back into green fields or open space? Has there been any pushing back of past sprawl?
No. I mean, and in fact, that's why we focused on the commercial corridors. We have the acres of parking lots and so forth, where it's a net gain for everybody. Mm-hmm. There are going to be increasing challenges for suburban neighborhoods. Professor Chris Nelson out of the University of Arizona, as well as Chris Leinberger here at GW, have both talked about how there is so much less demand for large lot single-family homes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've even speculated that they become boarding houses because there's so little demand in some parts of the country in these outer suburbs.
Now, if you go over towards the Chesapeake Bay, which, of course, is one of the founding coalition members for CSG, you do have the problem of global warming, all right? And sea levels are rising, and therefore coastal habitations mm-hmm. are increasingly threatened. There have been efforts, I think, in New Jersey and New York after different hurricanes, and perhaps in Maryland as well, where you see the state purchasing or the federal government purchasing land that previously was occupied by homeowners. I know there's definitely this has been happening in the Bayou in Louisiana. Is there anything that you've been working on to alleviate, to get properties that have been previously developed along waterways and to make those back into parkland?
We haven't within our mission, but it's certainly something that local governments need to be looking at when they update their comprehensive plans or master plans.
Mm-hmm.
We agree that, you know, the federal taxpayer shouldn't be on the hook to continue to replace homes that are flooded due to sea level rise and mm-hmm. storm surges that come with it, that the most equitable thing to do is to use that emergency funding to help move homes back to higher ground
mm-hmm.
in a secure place. You know, everything we're doing relates to climate change. If you just this year, transportation exceeded power generation as the biggest source of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions.
Hmm.
And that's because we've made some significant progress in the power sector, but we're not making progress on transportation. And transportation ties back to land use. So think about the 120,000 people who've moved to D.C. in the last 12 years. Each one is part of a climate solution, if you think about it, because they drive a lot less, some of them don't even own cars, and they're emitting far fewer greenhouse gas emissions. We even have something called Green Place to certify developments that offer this benefit. Now, Amy may have some more to add because of her experience with Katrina. And what were they doing down there?
Oh, a lot, and some of it very well and some of it not very well at all. New Orleans is an interesting foil to the D.C. region in that here in D.C. we are one of the success stories of smart growth and good planning. And New Orleans is a challenge in that if you look at the geography of the city, much of the city being under sea level and the parts of the city that are under sea level correlate directly with their socioeconomic status of the neighborhoods. There's a lot of historical wrongdoing to untangle there, and it's a very complicated issue, not unlike here, but with its own flavor and politics and history about who do we move where, and if we move them, are we helping them in the future, or are we taking away their cultural heritage? It's a fascinating discussion, but probably not one we have time
makes
for
makes our region look easy and simple.
So, you're right, we are approaching the end of this podcast, and so, as we do that, I'd like to ask a final question of each of you, keeping in mind the various the various influencing factors of sociology, anthropology, land use, transit, everything that that is represented by Coalition for Smarter Growth and the work that you do here. I'd like to ask Stuart, for you first, to just take a moment to reflect. Actually, both of you, perhaps at the same time, take a moment to reflect on what it is that has been motivating you throughout your years of public service, both here and elsewhere in the Navy, at other mass transit organizations before on the blog. And then I'd like you to take a moment and speak to our listeners about what you hope your legacy will be. At the end of your career, you'll have done a lot of work. What will be the impact of that? So basically, what's been motivating you, what inspires you, and then what will be your legacy once you have finished your career?
I've been thinking a lot about legacy recently because of all of the work that is going on in our region right now around Metro, the Washington area Metro transit system. And a generation ago, we built the Metro system, and it's a huge reason the region is what it is today. But we're coming to this point where it's sort of used up its first leg of infrastructure, and the things that we built then are wearing out now, and we're looking at a really once-in-a-generation fight for dedicated funding for Metro, and that's something, looking ahead, that if I could say at the end of my career, what was your crowning achievement? On my watch, the advocates of my generation got dedicated funding for Metro. That would be remarkable, and it's really just about, on a broader level, leaving things a little bit better in the public sector than I found them.
Well, I would echo that, leaving a restored world-class metro system for the next generation. But I think as well, having shaped a region that is the most sustainable in the world. We are the strongest, most successful country in the world.
We are the capital of that nation. We should show the way to grow sustainably in the next century and in fighting climate change. So we will have the lowest greenhouse gas emissions of any major metropolitan area in the world, and we will achieve that through the use of walkable transit-oriented communities, preserved farmland, restored streams, and having passed on a place where not only we want to continue to live, but generations to come will want to live.
And that has been Stuart Schwartz, the founder and executive director of the Coalition for Smarter Growth, a retired Navy captain, graduate of the Sorensen Institute, and Amy Custis, the deputy director of Coalition for Smarter Growth and an editor at the urbanist blog Greater Washington. They speak about, with great symbolism and with incredible nuance across a wide swath of categories, about the importance of sustainability. In some, you might be able to say that their message is to start small and seek to have great, large results. Whether they're talking about gentrification and the need to just ensure that people of various different socioeconomic classes are able to stay there, to concretely ensuring that there is a dedicated funding source for Metro, which is quite a large legacy that they hope to live. They're seeking to allow other individuals to live the dream. And for Stuart and Amy, public service has been about making stronger communities. And they use urban development and zoning and mass transit and sometimes very technical policy issues as a means of getting to what being in an American community is all about. Essentially, they're trying to create a home that we all would want to live in, a home not just for us, but a home for future generations. So with that, Stuart and Amy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks for having us. And if you're interested in learning more, you can always go to smartergrowth.net/join.
And I encourage you to go there, listeners. This has been episode 121 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Remember to subscribe at publicinterestpodcast.com on iTunes or on your podcast app on Apple products. Should you wish to communicate with Stuart Schwartz or Amy Custis, you can leave a voicemail, phone numbers on the Contact Us tab of the website, and that voicemail will be forwarded to them. Again, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.